This is Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Harry Reedy. Today is 20 July 2009. Mr. Reedy and I are both in the interview room on the campus of Texas Tech University in the Southwest Collections Library. Harry, I want to thank you again for consenting to sit down and discuss your experiences during the war with me. Really appreciate it.
Very welcome.
First, let's get some biographical information. Can you tell me when you were born and where?
I was born on December 25th, 1945, in Lebanon, Pennsylvania.
Lebanon, Pennsylvania. So you were a World War II baby, by the sounds of it?
Well, actually post-World War II, because the war was over by the time my father got out, but he was stationed in the Pacific, and his when he was discharged, in California, and close to San Francisco, where my mother was living. And he met my mother, and when he was just out of the war, and my mother was a war widow. She had her first husband was killed in the war in Europe, I believe, and so she had she'd already had a daughter who was being raised by the daughter's my mother's paternal grandparents. My mother wasn't raising her, and then she met my father, and ended up pregnant and getting married, and came east. She'd never been east before, to Pennsylvania, where my father was from. And I was born, and then 3 weeks after I was born, she decided to go back to California, and got a divorce back there. So I was raised by my paternal grandmother. My father committed suicide when I was 5 years old, so I wasn't really raised by him. I was raised by my grandmother, and never saw my mother until I was in my mid-20s again, when I went out to California to look her up.
Let me back up a little bit. I want to get on some of this other stuff, too.
Sure.
But what was your father's role in the war? Was he in the Pacific?
He was in the Pacific. He was stationed... My father actually enlisted in the Army in 1938, I think it was. That's my recollection. It could have been another year, but he enlisted before the war. My family was all farmers, dirt poor farmers. They were tenant farmers. My grandparents were tenant farmers in Virginia and moved to Pennsylvania so they could buy a farm, and they bought a farm. But it wasn't a real prosperous farm. It was just barely, they survived, basically. And I think my uncles, I had three uncles and two aunts. One aunt died when she was in her 20s. I never got to meet her. But of the four sons that my mother had, three of them left the farm for the service. My father first, because he was the older one. He enlisted. And I think he enlisted to get off the farm. And then the two others, when World War II came along, they enlisted in the war to leave the farm. Well, that left my grandmother ultimately sold the farm because she couldn't take care of herself. And my father enlisted, and he was actually, because he was a farmer, he went into the cavalry. Mm-hmm. And he was stationed in Arlington, in the cavalry unit that's stationed there that takes care of the caissons and, mm-hmm. and what have you for the National Cemetery. And I have pictures of him and Fort Myers in Arlington, where he was stationed for a while. And then, I don't know how this came about, because obviously I never had a chance to talk to him about it, but he somehow ended up in... Well, actually, Fort Myer was one of the initial... places where they had the Army Air Corps, because he did have photos of airplanes. And I think he somehow ended up in the Army Air Corps. And then when the war started, he ultimately, in the last, for a year, whatever time he spent in the Pacific, he was stationed in the Aleutians. And he was sent to the Aleutians, and he was an air traffic controller for one of the air bases in the Aleutians. And that's, which is interesting, because he never really saw combat there. Japanese never made it up that far. But I have one picture of him. He's in full combat gear, you know, helmet, a rifle, everything on a hill, like he's going to charge up a hill. And what he was as an air traffic controller. Yeah, so it was, which was okay. I mean, I think that was, he did his duty, and no reason, the only reason the Japanese couldn't get up that far is they didn't have the resources to get up that far. So.
Mm-hmm. But when you're in a war, you have to take every opportunity to get those pictures so your kids can look at those
exactly.
pictures, even if they're not even close to what you actually did in the conflict.
Exactly.
So he spent the entire war in the Aleutians then?
He spent his combat tour in the Aleutians. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think he was stationed at other bases as well, but the combat tour was in the Aleutians.
Okay. So when they came back to Pennsylvania,
yeah,
and this would have been what, 45, you're born in Pennsylvania, Lebanon. Okay, what was your father going to do for a living, or what did he want to do?
Well, I think he did. It was. I don't know exactly how he made his determination, but he went into steelworking. He ultimately, I think he went down, I know he lived in Baltimore for a while. He got married a third time, and it was a really bad relationship, and he lived down in Baltimore with that woman for a while, and I think he was working in the steel mills there, and then he moved out to Pittsburgh. And he worked in the steel mills in Pittsburgh. And during that time, I don't really live with him. I spent some time with him in Baltimore. The only memory I have of living with him and his third wife was sitting on the steps of a trailer and listening to them arguing about me being there. And I had to be 4 years old. I mean, I can't have been very old. And I'm sitting in the trailer listening to them arguing about me being there. And I still remember that. And I remember the trailer and the setting, seems like it was near a body of water. But most of the time I lived with my grandmother. My grandmother raised me, and that was a very positive influence. I mean, I had a very happy childhood. I was very much loved by my grandmother and my aunt, the one aunt that survived. She's 13 years older than I am. So she was in her teens as I was growing up and young, and she and my grandmother were my caretakers, and they were just absolutely—they were wonderful. I don't remember anything but having a happy childhood outside of those few little moments.
Sure. Well, tell me about that. As you were being raised by your grandmother and your Aunt Betty, what sort of things did you do as a kid? What sort of things were you playing? What was school like? Tell me about that.
Okay. Well, I have to sort of differentiate between the time I started school when I was five. And before that, before I started school, we lived in the country. And we lived in a rented house in the country. And my grandmother, for income, would clean houses. And I remember going with her to clean houses. And she didn't drive. My grandmother never drove, never flew in an airplane. She obviously went in cars, but she couldn't drive a car. And and I remember walking with her along country roads, going to whatever house she was going to clean, and picking dandelion for greens for dinner, and I just remember that as being a very fun experience when I was younger than five. I was whatever age that was, and then we did live in the place that we rented. We lived in two rental places. The first one had several neighboring houses, and they had kids that played there, and kids that I had played with, and I remember playing with them, and I remember some of the fun things I remember was we always grew our own vegetables, and I remember loving to go out to the vegetable patch and eating a fresh tomato out there. That was, I always enjoyed that. I really enjoyed living in the country and going up, when it was potato picking time, going up to the neighbor's potato field and help them dig up potatoes. 4 years old, I don't know how good I was at it, but I probably got a potato or two out. And then the second place we lived was out on top of a hill. I really loved that place. It was a place that had a lot of big trees, and I remember in the fall with the leaves falling, just playing in the leaves there. I was pretty much alone at that time. But one of my uncles, third uncle in line. The oldest uncle had a handicap, so he never served in the war. My father was the second, and the third one served in the Pacific as well. He served in the South Pacific. He was a radio man. After he got out of the Army, he started his own radio TV business. Hmm. And because of that, when I was 4 years old, we had a TV in the house. I mean, this is 1949.
That's a big mess.
And we had a TV in the house, and that's when I started my addiction to TV. I remember living on that hill in Pennsylvania and watching TV a lot. I mean, there weren't any kids on that hill, so it was just me. And I remember that's when I started watching TV a lot. And I love TV, I still do. And I remember playing a lot. But around that time, that's when my father committed suicide. And that's a significant memory, because I remember the viewing, and I remember the funeral service. I remember the whole thing. That was traumatic. And then we moved, thanks to a woman that was, my grandmother was cleaning a house for a woman down the street from the first place I remember living. And this woman said, you know, you can collect Social Security. My grandmother was born in 1893. So by 1950, she was 57 years old. And she said, you know, you can collect Social Security for Harry, and veterans benefits for Harry. My grandmother just had no clue about these things.
Sure.
She was clueless. And so this woman, her name was Mrs. Wolf, was instrumental in helping my grandmother get access to veterans compensation. And actually, that's how we live from that point on. My grandmother had some money from selling the farm. What she did when she sold the farm, she gave $1,000 to each of her sons. She gave $1,000 to. She took the $1,000 that she'd given to my father and got back through insurance and used that to pay for a down payment for a house in town. I say in town, it was, Lebanon, Pennsylvania is not a big town, 40,000 people maybe, and we actually lived in the suburb, even though we looked like the town, I was part of the school system that was in the country. So I went to a country school, mm-hmm. even though I lived in the town. And so she bought a house, that we lived in. But she didn't work. What we lived on basically, the whole time I grew up, was my father's veterans benefits, and then when she could get Social Security, her Social Security check. So because of that, I started working when I was 10. Mm-hmm. I started working at my uncle had a. My youngest uncle came out of the service and did a bunch of different jobs, and ultimately worked for a dairy and had his own milk route. And he was a milkman for his entire life. And I worked for him for about 6-7 years, from the time I was 10 until probably the time I was 16, I think. I didn't work when I was a senior in high school. But so that's... So that's sort of how it happened before I was five. Once I turned five, we lived in that suburban area in town. Mm-hmm. My life was very different there because it was more like city living. I went to a country high school. My graduating class only had 53 people in it. But I lived in town, and I was raised like a city kid would be raised. We played with the kids in the neighborhood. I ran around with the kids in the neighborhood, got in trouble with the kids in the neighborhood, had pretty much, and it was a neighborhood that was very poor. You know, I never realized it until I was an adult that I was a poor kid. I mean, we didn't have any money. I mean, the money I earned from the milk truck, I used to buy school clothes for school. I never realized I was poor because I had a happy home, and I, you know, was with kids that were like me, and they didn't realize they were poor either. We just had fun together. We play out in the, there's a little undeveloped area outside of our little neighborhood called the weeds. and we go out there and play Army all day long and just have a ball, and did all the stuff that kids aren't allowed to now because they'll get hurt.
Right. Yeah. Or somebody might possibly get hurt and be a lawsuit and fall right up.
Right.
What about high school? What was high school like for you?
I did well in school, and high school I always thought was probably my shining achievement. I thought that for a number of years. I've changed my mind since, but I always thought I did well in high school. I actually started school young because of being born December 25th. I could have gone the next year, or I could have gone the year I did. So I was one of the youngest kids in my class. I mean, when I graduated when I was 17, but I did very well. I academically did extremely well. I was not athletic. I didn't mature physically until I was in college. Mm. While I was in high school, I was just a complete waste. I couldn't do it. Athletically, I couldn't do anything. But academically, I did very well. I ended up second in my class. It wasn't a big class, but I ended up second in my class. I think I should have been first, but I don't argue those things. And, got awards. It got tiny little scholarships. But the high school experience was very, very positive for me because I was academically exceptional. So that was very positive for me.
Now, throughout your high school years, of course, you're born in 1945, and the Cold War begins even before World War II ends. Growing up in rural Pennsylvania, poor kid, poor family, what did you know about what was going on internationally? Did you pay any attention? Was there any of this that kind of seeped in? Did you actively seek out any information on the U.S. and the world?
No. It was very insular. I wasn't much aware of what was going around. The only thing that I paid attention to, because my grandmother did, was national politics, mm-hmm. and what was happening with national politics. Internationally, I just wasn't aware of a lot of things. I do vaguely remember, because I was a TV kid, mm-hmm. and I watched TV, and I remember the McCarthy hearings, and I do remember watching those. But I think I was just as interested in the Miss America contest.
I wonder why.
And I remember those as
Jim
well.
McCarthy or Miss America.
Our little community, when I talked to my grandmother about her experience during the Depression, because that was a significant event while she was going through her adulthood, she says, I don't remember much about it. It never really affected us because we were farmers and we raised our own food and we took care of ourselves. And what depression? Her life didn't really change. She wasn't in the central part of the country. She was in Pennsylvania where they didn't have a Dust Bowl. They were able to live their life relatively normally. And I think to some extent that was the same in our environment, in where I lived in our little neighborhood was called Hebron. Mm-hmm. And when I lived in Hebron, we had our own little world, our own little piece of the country, and I never thought much about world politics or what was going on in the world at all. I was probably just thought more about what was happening to me and what I was going to be doing. So I wasn't aware of it, mm-hmm. not a lot.
Well, what about the big events? I mean, looking at things like Sputnik, for example, or the Cuban Missile Crisis, or the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Well, certainly Sputnik. I do remember in school, they would have announcements, and I was aware of what was happening with Sputnik, and I was aware of the contest, certainly with Kennedy. My grandmother always loved Eisenhower, and I think that's probably because she lived through the war, and he was the hero, and he was the war president. I mean, the post-war president. And I always remember, and I mean, I because I she set the tone for my thoughts. I always thought Eisenhower had to be a great president, and never knew any better about that. And then I remember in the election, I actually, when it was Kennedy and Nixon, I do remember watching that on television. And I do remember, because my grandmother was a Republican, I thought I should be a Republican too. And I do remember thinking that I should be in favor of Nixon. And and whatever we did in school, if we had mock elections or whatever we did, I'm sure I was a Nixon proponent at that point in time. And then I had no idea who Kennedy was, no clue about Kennedy, and I had no impression of Kennedy whatsoever, except that I knew that Russia was getting ahead of us in the space race, and I knew we had to do something. And I remember Kennedy's pronouncement that, you know, we were going to get on the moon by the end of the decade. I do remember that those things, being impressive. I don't know how much I paid them outside of just what I was presented with. Intellectually, I don't think I spent a lot of time dealing with it.
Well, knowing you now, it's hilarious that you would have been a Nixon supporter.
Yeah, isn't it?
Back in 1960. Well, as a young man, 1960, of course, the election, 61 with the Bay of Pigs, then.
And I don't think I was even much aware of that. I mean, as an event, historically, I'm aware of what the Bay of Pigs meant, but I don't know. I don't remember how much of that I paid attention to when I was in high school.
What about the Cuban Missile Crisis? Very tense and frightening moment.
Again, I remember it, but it doesn't seem to... I don't remember having a significant... I don't think at that point in time I realized how significant it was. Mm-hmm. I don't think I gained some understanding of the import of that event until later on. Mm-hmm. During it, I don't think so.
Yeah.
That was, what year was that, 19...
62 was the...
1962. Oh, that's when I was in love, so I was probably more... I was probably more interested in my first girlfriend than anything else.
Well, you should have been, I would say. All right. When did you graduate high school?
63.
In 1963.
Yeah.
All right, so you're 17 years old, 1963.
Yeah.
What did you want to do?
Well, see, there again, I was misled. Thinking that... You know, and this is probably one impact of the era, actually. You know, when you're graduating high school and thinking about going on to a career, this is the beginning of the age of technology and space and getting somebody on the moon. The thing that I thought I had to be was an aerospace engineer, because I was bright and I understand science, I understand mathematics. I should be an aerospace engineer. So, I mean, there wasn't even a question about it. I don't remember having any other opinion other than I needed to be an aerospace engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably because of that era. And so I looked at engineering schools, and I had small little scholarships, but mainly I had my income from my father, his veterans benefits, that were going to pay for a lot of my education. I might have to work a little bit, but a lot of the tuition was paid from that check that I got from my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so I looked at engineering schools and decided on Penn State because it was the more reasonably priced one that made it very affordable for me, and went off to Penn State. Well, what I found when I got there was that the science and math that I was getting in college was very different from the science and math that I got in my little country high school.
In what way?
Much more challenging.
Mm-hmm.
Much more challenging, and in high school, I didn't even have to think about it, and I could do it. In college, even when I thought about it, it was hard, and I really had a question... Is this what I really want to do? And I got thrown into a tizzy. I mean, I'd never failed academically at all. And I went into my first year there. I mean, there are some required courses. One of them is engineering mechanics. And I went into that course, and I couldn't get it. I got D's, and ultimately I failed the course. It's the first time in my life I'd ever failed anything. Never failed anything before. I mean, that was a significant moment in my life, because I never failed anything. I failed engineering mechanics.
How'd you deal with that?
Oh, not well. Not well at all. I went into amounts to a depression, even though I don't. Clinically, it probably was. And I didn't do well. And my second semester, I barely got by. Came home, got a job for the summer, went back, and had to take this course again. It's a required course. And this is where this shows you where my mind was. The professor's name, and this guy who wrote the book, is named Hardenberg. And I'll always remember him. I remember what he looks like. He looks like his name. And I walked into his class in my sophomore year, sat down. I knew it was the same book, but I wasn't sure who was teaching class. He walked into the class and I walked out. I never dropped the course. I just walked out.
Ooh.
And I never went back, and I never dropped the course. So I automatically got an F. You know, where was my mind? Well, I decided I need to do something about it. I went to counseling. And I went to counseling, and that really helped. You know, the counselor said, you know, maybe, you know, pure engineering isn't what you're cut out for. You know, have you ever considered doing something else? And I said, well, no. And she said, well, you need to consider doing something else. And so she got me into thinking about, even though it was still engineering, I graduated in industrial engineering. I took a lot of business management, and I took a lot of computer science courses. And I really liked the business management and computer science courses. Mm-hmm. And so through all of that, with the help of her advice, I was able to find subject matter that really interested me. But I was still in engineering, and guess what? I still had to take engineering mechanics to graduate. I couldn't graduate as an engineer without taking it. And you only have three chances. If you don't do it the third time, you're dead. So because I'd screwed up my freshman and sophomore year, I had to go to school the summer term between my junior and senior year. And that's when I decided to take engineering mechanics again. Same book, same professor.
Could not get away from him.
I got a B. You know, it's all, and it was all a matter of mindset. You know, sure. At that point in time, I knew what I wanted, I knew where I wanted to go, and I knew, well, that was just a stepping stone, and it's something I had to do. And it wasn't, I didn't perceive it as something I couldn't do, which is where I was 2 years before that. It was just something I had to do. So I did it, and I got a B. And I could have gotten a B the first time around, except my head wasn't there. And it all had to do, I think that was a real good learning experience, because I understood that it all had to do with where your head was, not with what you were capable of doing, but where your head was. As long as your head is there, you're able to do it. And if your head's not there, don't waste your time with it. So that was a real good learning experience for me. And so I graduated with not a great average. It was I don't know, 2.7, something like that. I don't know. So, you know, I had a bunch of terrible grades, and I had a bunch of good grades, so I ended up in the middle somewhere.
Mm-hmm. It was part of this overall maturing process that going to college for the first time, leaving home, all those kind of things. time will help take care of those kind of things.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. And during that time as well, I matured physically. And you know, for the first time in my life, I was starting to enjoy sports. So I was out there playing basketball with, you know, people who had played basketball for 5 years, and I was playing other athletics. And Penn State was a school that at the time required phys ed, so you had to take phys ed. And even though I took my, you know, bowling and golf and those things, I had to take some hard stuff too. And I took wrestling and got in the best shape I've ever been in my life to that point in time in one semester of wrestling. And so it was sort of fun for me too, because physically I felt I was finally growing up a little bit, and intellectually I was more in control than I was. So emotionally I was pretty much of a wreck, but that's
why do you say that?
Oh, I got dumped really hard. I had a summer job between my junior and my freshman and sophomore year. I worked at a little country store, and the owner had a daughter that I fell in love with, and so we had a relationship for a couple of years, and then I became very close with her family. I mean, really, really close. As close as I've been to any family. They were just wonderful people. And during my junior year, she went away to school for something, I don't remember what it was, in Reading, Pennsylvania. And she met this guy, and she ended up getting pregnant. And I found out about it from her sister, who said, when I came home from school one weekend, said, "Why don't we go out to dinner?" I said, "Okay, fine." That's when she told me, and I was absolutely emotionally wrecked, totally wrecked. I mean, I couldn't date. I couldn't even go out with. I don't think I dated. I might have gone out with one person my senior year, because I was wrecked emotionally. Because I'm totally in love with that young woman, totally, and I. You know, had she not done that, I wouldn't have a doubt that it would have developed into a long-term relationship. But she what was ironic, this is jumping ahead a couple of years, is that I was real good friends with her older sister, who told me that and it was a real close one for the family. I mean, ironically, even after she did that, I was close friends with the family, and I worked at the store between my junior and senior year. I was out for a month or so, and I went back to the store and just helped out at the store. And I was good, close friends with the family. And even while she was, you know, getting married to this guy and having her baby, and after Linda and I met briefly, just after we were married, her older sister got married, and we were invited. She didn't have a best. She didn't have a bridesmaid. She had two best men, because she had more men's friends than me. I was one of her best men, and so we went to the wedding, and I mean, Linda got to meet her and thought that she was hitting on me, which I think she probably was. But but I mean, she had destroyed me for emotionally a brief period of time. So I physically, intellectually, I was doing well. Emotionally, it was a wreck when I graduated, but. I ended up with a job that I thought I'd really like, working for the telephone company, as an engineer in the telephone company. And that's where I met Linda, because she was working in the engineering department as well, part-time. So.
All right. Now, you've made your way through the rocky straits of Penn State and love and all these other different things. Now you're not insulated anymore.
No.
You're not in yeah. Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Now you're around other people, other young people, professors. We've got, of course, this war in Vietnam. You graduated in 63 from high school, so I guess 4 years probably.
Yeah.
So in 1967, you're going to be graduating, and you're in your early 20s.
Yeah.
What did you know about what was going on?
Oh, I knew. I was very much aware of it, because there weren't young men my age who weren't aware of what was happening in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And that was very much on our minds. Now, Penn State wasn't What I was surprised at is the level of political protest there was that was going on in other parts of the country once I was out of Penn State. Mm-hmm. But at Penn State, for whatever reason, and I don't know what that might be, but there wasn't as much political protest going on in 1967 as there might have been in other places. I wasn't aware of it. I was aware, as most of my classmates were who were men, because we had to sign up for the draft. We were aware that as long as we were in school, we were not going to be drafted, but then we were eligible for it after. And I mean, some people actually looked for jobs that would provide them with protection. Mm-hmm. But I knew when I took this job that wasn't going to be the case, that I'd be eligible for the draft. You know, you always hope that it would you could avoid it, but I knew that was a possibility. And the employers knew that too. You know, they were perfectly aware of that, but there were enough laws in place that protected people who mm-hmm. were drafted so that, you know, you knew that you had a job anyway. So I was aware of it.
Were you following it closely at all? Were you like, okay, I got these Marines that are here, we've got the Viet Cong, and did you have an idea or an awareness of what the setup was there and then what the U.S. involvement was going to mean?
I don't think I had a detailed knowledge of it. You know, I had a knowledge, I had whatever information was presented on the media, mm-hmm. you know.
Which was considerable.
Yeah, a lot more than ever before, certainly. I don't think I had any sense tactically of what was going on. Strategically, I might have understood. My comprehension was, at that point in time, in 1967, was that we were really there protecting people. I think I believed that we were there for a good reason, a positive reason, and we were fighting communism. I think that's what I believed at that point in time. And so I didn't think that our purpose there was not a good purpose. Mm. I thought it was a right thing to do. And I'm pretty sure I came out of college with that mindset. I was aware that there were a lot of people resisting the draft. Mm-hmm. And I was aware that there were people going to Canada and there were people resisting the draft. And I knew that that was an alternative. I didn't know anyone who did, but I knew that that was an alternative. And I remember consciously thinking to myself, well, I don't think that's something I want to do. I for a couple of reasons. One is, I have a family history of doing what you need to do for your country. You know, I had three uncles who volunteered to serve. And my uncle Earl had to go to three recruiting stations before they take him because he was short.
Right.
And that's how much he wanted to get into World War II. He went to three different recruiting stations until one of them took him. And so I had this history of patriotism, if you want to call it that, and I felt like, well, it's my duty. If I'm drafted, that's my duty to serve. And as well, I thought military experience isn't something that is necessarily wasn't something that I dreaded. I initially, when I was just a kid, I thought I wanted to go to West Point, and I remember. I remember marching around the house when I was a younger kid, just pretending that I was one of the plebes at West Point, and I thought that was an alternative until I got old enough to realize that there's to get into West Point's as much a political connection as anything, and I had no political connection, so I gave up that idea, and I don't know how well I would have done anyway, but military, being a part of the military was never anything foreign to me.
Well, it was something positive in your background.
Yes.
It sounds like
yes.
Yes. Family history.
Now the one thing I left out I probably should have mentioned was that because of that as well, when I started at Penn State, I was in ROTC. What was very telling, though, was I only stayed with it for a year because I couldn't stand the regimentation. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't stand the regimentation. It drove me a little nuts. And I just thought, I can't do this for 4 years. I just can't do it. And so, but that was along with all the other shit that was happening, you know, all the other mental problems I was having. You know, had I not been going through the turmoil that I've been going through, I might have handled that better, but I didn't handle that very well. So I just dropped it. Going forward to when I graduated, though, the idea of going into the military wasn't a negative one to me. Mm-hmm. It was a positive thought. However, I wasn't looking forward to going to Vietnam, and so I you know, when the draft notice came, you know, everybody was sorry to hear about that, but that's okay. You know, I'll live with it. And I remember getting on the train in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and taking a train trip down to Columbia, South Carolina, where I went to Fort Jackson for basic training. And I was, you know, that whole process I was okay with. Now, and going through basic training, I was okay with it. Physically, I developed a real good friend named Pinkney. He was a guy, a black kid from countryside in North Carolina. And he was just like, he was a perfect physical specimen. I mean, this kid, I don't think physically there's anything he couldn't do. He was just incredibly strong and coordinated. It wasn't any bigger than me. He was just physically incredible. And I remember we had to do the monkey bars, you mm-hmm. know, the where you have to go across like that. And he would go two at a time. He'd just boom, 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 and he'd be across them like that. And I would be struggling across the goddamn things. It was terrible. But physically, some of the things were tough for me. The upper body was always tough for me. And the stuff that I had to do upper body, where my strength was, because I worked on the milk truck for so long, I've always had strong legs and lower body, and I could do the marches, and I could do all that stuff, and I love shooting the weapons. I mean, that was really, really fun for me, and I ended up, which you know, I had an uncle who was a real macho type of guy, and because I was so inept when I was younger, really thought I was sort of a wimp, and I was, and when I went into the when I with the M14, I shot expert. And it was one of my fondest memories is going home with my uniform on with the expert badge, showing him I shot expert. that was sort of fun.
Take me through a typical day in boot camp. It's Fort Jackson, you said.
Fort Jackson. Yeah. Yeah. Fort Jackson was when I went through, it was February, March, and April, and so at night it was very cold, and when you get up in the morning, it's just really cold, and there was no hot water, so you get up in the morning and have to shave with cold water, and then go out, get ready to do PT, and I don't remember what order it was. I think we ate first, or we might have done PT first, then we ate, then we'd go through some sort of not classroom, but open classroom training, and then some sort of physical exercise of some hike or other. The classroom training, I just remember, as being somewhat boring. I don't know how much people learned of those things. You'd have an instructor, you'd be sitting in like a little stand, and the instructor would be out there explaining things to you, and maybe then you'd get a chance to go off and practice with whatever you had to practice on. And then you'd go for a hike or whatever physical training there was. You know, that it was, you know, it was like camp. Mm. You know, my memory is that I didn't think I was learning a lot that was going to be useful in saving my life, except shooting a gun, because I could use that. And the physical exercise. I mean, there are two times in my life I was in good physical shape. One was that semester where I took wrestling, and the other was after basic training. I mean, I got in good physical shape in basic training. I think that's one thing they do for you. If they weed out the people who don't who don't get in shape, because you have to be a grunt. You have to be in good physical shape. You don't question about it, and they do that. And I don't know if basic training does anything more than get me in shape and get people used to the idea of taking orders.
Right.
That's probably the other significant thing they did. They get used to taking orders. You take orders. You get in good physical shape. I don't know if you learn anything that's going to help you stay alive, but those are the two things that they did do. I always remember my drill sergeant. He was a Filipino. The nights were cold, but then the days got really, really hot. Mm-hmm. And in Fort Jackson, it's pine trees and sand. And you get out there and do your, you know, the physical activity out in the pine barrens. And it's just hot. And, you know, you get a break and you just sit down and just want to sit. And he'd say, you know, when it was time for the break of the order, he'd say, on your feet. But the way he said it was, on your feet. And I'll always remember that. On your feet. And that was the worst phrase in the world. It was on your feet. Because that meant the break was over. You had to get up and go on with what you were doing. It was a routine, and I absorbed whatever I had to absorb. But at the same time, while you're going through basic training, you get the opportunity to think about what you're going to do as an MOS. My thinking was I want to do anything that avoids going to Vietnam for as long as possible. And of course they put you through the whole battery of tests and stuff, which I did well on. Whatever tests they did, I did well, and they basically let me do anything I wanted to do. And one of the things they wanted me to do was fly a helicopter, and I thought about that for a while, very short while. I thought about that because I would have kept me out of Vietnam for a while, but then
would have certainly
over in Vietnam, it'd be putting me in air as a target, and right. I didn't know how much I wanted to do that. And so ultimately, I decided not to be a helicopter pilot, and as well because I did well on the tests. They put me into school for sergeant training so that I go over to Vietnam as a sergeant. Mm-hmm. And that one I gave a lot of thought to.
And, the shake and bake program, what they called it. Yeah. 90 days,
yeah.
Sergeant 90 days.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. But what it does is keep you out of Vietnam an extra 3 months.
Yeah, for 9 days, yeah.
So that was sort of intriguing to me too.
Tell me about that school. I want to know more about this 90-day school.
Yeah.
Sergeant training. Tell me about that.
I don't know about it. I never went through it.
Oh, you didn't go? Okay, I'm sorry.
No. I just, that was an option
that
I was considering, because I was considering options that would keep me away from Vietnam for as long as possible. And that was an option I was thinking about. Because one of the things you have to understand too is that you've got these, I mean, the Filipino drill sergeant, I can't remember his name now. He was such a character. But he was the head drill sergeant. And then there were these other guys who had served tours of duty in Vietnam who were sort of like his direct staff who took care of the troops. And he was a lifer. I mean, the other guys were just, they had finished their tours of duty and were finishing out their, enlistment. Doing this stuff, and they were regular guys, but they'd already been to Vietnam. So these guys were there talking to you about, well, this is what it is, this is what it's like, and
what sort of things were they saying?
It was a dangerous place to be, you know, for a lot of different reasons. If we had a vision of what war was like from watching the World War II shows, it was nothing like that, because it was jungle fighting and you didn't always know exactly where the enemy was, and it was dangerous. When I remember learning to use the claymore, mm-hmm. and I remember that being very impressive, because you actually shot one off, and he saw what it could do. And them talking about, you know, the dangers of that kind of environment. So they put a scare into you about the type of war it was, and that it wasn't, if you had a concept previously of what war was based upon everything else that you'd learned about Korea or Europe or World War II, that it wasn't the same thing. It was a different kind of war, and it was a dangerous kind of war. That's the impression that you got from those guys, which is good.
Right.
I mean, that's exactly the kind of impression that they should leave with, because that makes you want to think that, well, you got to find ways to learn how to survive. And to the extent, I got to give them credit, even though I said I didn't learn anything useful, to the extent that they could, when there was something that you were learning, that they could explain how this was helpful. Like, I remember thinking, well, the Claymore is probably one of the best tools you're going to have, because you can set that up around you so that it will kill people before they get to you. If you're going to learn, you learn to use weapons, and you learn to use them well.
What weapons did you use? You talk about the M14 and the Claymore. What other kind of weapons training did you receive?
Oh, the 45, which I was absolutely hopeless with. I just couldn't hit. I couldn't hit that wall with a 45. It was just too powerful for me. I didn't have, like I said, upper body. I think if you had a lot of good upper body strength and you had strong arms, you could keep that thing steady and hit whatever you wanted to. But I mean, it's a very powerful weapon. But I just couldn't. I just couldn't hit anything with it. The weapon I was, and the grenade launcher was sort of fun too. I liked using the grenade launcher.
The M79.
Yeah, and the weapon I absolutely loved though was the 50 caliber machine gun. I love the 50 caliber because it's just so destructive. It was just so much. It was fun to fire that weapon. It was just so much fun to see how it could tear up something. I really enjoyed the 50 caliber machine gun. Would not be like on the other end of.
You would be on the other end of the
that, no. No, so those were the, and obviously grenades. You got to practice with grenades too, but and that's about it. Just the pretty much the basic stuff. I mean, firing the weapons I liked, the mechanics of it I liked. If I was just firing at a firing range, I liked. I didn't know how I'd feel about it if I had to fire it at a live person. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of a disconnect. I sort of put a barrier up between the actual thing I was doing and why I was doing it. Mm-hmm. I hadn't gotten to the point where I was thinking about, okay, now I'm aiming this thing at an actual live person. How am I going to feel about that? I never got to that point. I put that off. And I probably would have continued putting it off until I was in country and had to do it. I don't know how I would have acted or reacted then, but the mechanics of it I enjoyed, and I still would today. I mean, I enjoy going out to a firing range and shooting a gun today. I think I just could never shoot. I could never shoot anything that's alive. I couldn't do it. In a typical day, that's pretty much what it was, routine. And you learn some things, but I was never really certain that I learned enough to save my life in going through basic training. It was an interesting group of people that I was with. I developed some friends, like I told you. I developed, actually, there was somebody from my hometown who was in basic training at the same time I was.
Right.
So I got to know him, and I told you about Pinckney and a couple of other guys. We just, developed friendships, and we were all from all different places. I mean, I was a college graduate, Pinckney was a high school graduate. My other friend was a farmer, and, in basic training, it's sort of an amalgam. Mm-hmm. And it was people who enlisted and people who were drafted, people who wanted to make the military career and people who were just in for their 2 years. So it was a real amalgam, and I think there was a little more camaraderie and basic training, and I felt comfortable in it. Although I was looking for options to stay away from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened to me, right in the middle of basic training, 4 weeks in, I guess, I got a call from someone in the Pentagon, a colonel in the Pentagon, and out of the blue, and they just called me into the company quarters, company office, and said, you got a call. So I took the call, and it was a colonel of the Pentagon. He asked me about my, because I'd taken computer courses in college, and because the job I had coming out of college, I was mechanizing some manual routines, computerizing them. He asked me questions about my experience and what I did, and I answered those questions, and that was sort of the end of it. But in the back of my mind, I thought, that's interesting. I wonder why they were doing that.
And after only 4 weeks of basic training,
yeah,
you should have been doing push-ups the entire time, let alone talking to colonels on the telephone about computer mechanization.
Right, exactly. But I had that in mind, too, and I thought, well, maybe that'll lead to something. Who knows? I mean, if they call me, then who knows what's going to happen. And so, I managed to get through basic training and do everything I have to do, and pretty much decided that I'd go the route of that sergeant training, because that'd keep me out. So I was going to do that if I had to. But I was still hoping that, they'd announce something else. Like they would take people out of basic training and put them into, if you were a draftee, they would take you out and put you into another job. They would put you into another specialty at times. And I always thought, well, maybe there's a chance that would happen. And I remember the formation, the morning that they announced, it was, at the end of the 8 weeks, where they announced where you were going to be assigned. And you stand in formation, and they read off your name, and they tell you your assignment. And, most of it, all of the people who enlisted got assignments that weren't advanced infantry or whatever. Mm-hmm. And most, if not all, of the people who were drafted got advanced infantry assignments. Mm-hmm. And it came along to my name, and there it was, advanced infantry, Fort Jackson.
What did you think about that?
After the formation was over, and I kicked my foot locker so hard I dented the toe. And if you know what those army boots are like, their toes are pretty hard.
So you are going to go to the AIT. Rifle company, AIT, and then it looks like that's what's going to happen.
Oh, there's no question about it. Mm-hmm. This company at Fort Jackson, this training company at Fort Jackson, for the prior, the number escapes me now, but it's at least 14, 15, 12 to 15 training companies. Mm-hmm. Everyone went to Vietnam out of that training company. I mean, that training company trained people to go to Vietnam. And actually, that's where, like I said, basic training didn't really teach you how to survive. I think AIT was meant to help you learn the rudimentaries of how to survive. I mean, after I talked to other people, I learned that it was only when you got there did you really learn how you were going to survive. This is just sort of rudimentary, but nonetheless, I saw that it was helpful, and I could see that the training was a little more advanced. It wasn't much different in style, but I felt like they did push you a little bit, and they gave you a little more feeling for what it was going to be you had to do. And and that's the first time I shot the M14, too, which was not a pleasure. I didn't like that gun at all. I like
the M14 or the M16?
I mean, I'm sorry, the M16. The M14 is what I had in basic, and I qualified with. The M16, after using the M14, which I thought was a really, really nice weapon, I thought the M16 was a piece of shit, and I didn't like it at all. And
that's
and
the common refrain from everybody who used both of them.
I mean, as it happened, I never had to qualify with it, but
I was going through training, and
the training, as I said, was very similar to the basic training, except maybe they gave you a little more insight into what you had to know, and there was more physical activity, more than classroom. It was more physical and more. I felt like it was more in the brush, which I wasn't really great at either, but. I was going through it. I mean, I was going through it and really ready to sign on the bottom line for going to the sergeant training. And it was really, it's ironic how it happened. It was the day before we were to qualify with the M16. And we finished in the shooting range and I just thought, fuck, I really would love to get expert with this, but I don't even know if I'm going to qualify with this thing. It just didn't.
What was it? Is it a lighter weapon?
It was lighter. It didn't feel as stable to me. Mm. It was not as stable a platform, and I just didn't feel like I had the control over. I felt like I, with the M14, I could control where that bullet was going. With the M16, I just didn't feel like I had complete control over where that bullet was going, and it just never developed comfort level with it. And so we went back, and I knew the next day I was qualifying with it. I was dreading it, and I went back, and first thing you do, coming back from the firing range, is clean the weapon, and you take it to the weapons room. And I was there cleaning my weapon, and it called me out, and said, "Reedy, what? You've got to report to the orderly room, company orderly room." I said, "Okay, fine. Want me to do it now?" "No, no, wait till you clean your weapon and put it away." And that's no rush. Put my weapon away and go to the orderly room, and they say, "Who do you know?" "What do you mean, who do I know?" I say, "Well, who do you know?" "I don't know anybody." He said, "You got to know somebody." "No, I don't know anybody." "Why? What are you talking about?" And he said, "Well, you've been reassigned. You're going to Fort Myer, Virginia." I said, "Where's that?" He said, "I don't know, some base in Virginia." I said, "What for?" I said, "I don't know. You're gonna clear base tomorrow." And I said, "Oh, okay, fine." And I didn't realize when they say, "Who do you know?" that nobody ever was pulled out of AIT in that training company before. And the next day it was so funny. The next day I cleared post, almost every station in clearing post. They say, "Who do you know?" It's like I had to know somebody for me to be pulled out of AIT, that AIT company.
Now, when was this? This would have been, what, 68 by this time, or still in 67?
Because
you've graduated, you worked for a short time, then you went through 8 weeks.
It's 68.
Okay, or 68.
If it's February, March, April, this would probably be May of 68.
Okay.
And so I didn't even know. I mean, finally, I found out from someone who knew that Fort Myer was the base that served the Pentagon, and so I finally put it together that that call that I got in the middle of basic training paid off because that's where I was going to go work, that's ultimately how I ended up not going to Vietnam. Because I got that job. I got to go to the bathroom again, and then...
Oh,
I
sure.
Can, I can...
Let's take a break.
Let's talk about it.
Okay, now, you would... In AIT, you're going to get pulled out of this. Before we get you up to Fort Myer here,
yep.
One thing that I've noticed as you were talking about how you were going through basic training in AIT, you used the word survive a lot. You never once used the phrase, "Make me an effective combat soldier." You never once brought up the idea that you might, instead of just trying to survive this damn thing, that you might actually be trying to make a positive effect on the American war effort. For you, as you understood it, it was survival.
Yep.
Now, what was it about your understanding of the Vietnam War and the individual's experience in the Vietnam War that led you to focus on survival rather than being an effective soldier?
Well, I think there's a couple of aspects to that. One is that I didn't enlist. I was drafted. You know, I think unlike someone who might have enlisted, like my father and two uncles, they probably enlisted because they had a clear purpose and they wanted to become an effective soldier so that they could effectively carry out their mission, whatever that was. And that was probably the case with the other people that had enlisted. They wanted to become a professional at what they were doing. I was drafted. I did this as an obligation, as a duty. And when I got there and I started to realize what kind of war it was, what kind of fighting this was, it's something totally different from anything I'd ever experienced. I truly believe that to be an effective combat soldier, you have to be physically very, very fit. If you weren't physically very, very fit, you had a diminished chance of being a good soldier. And I'd always had these, I've always had these nagging doubts about my physical capabilities, and even through basic training, some things were harder for me than others. And so, from my perspective, it wasn't becoming the best soldier I could become. It's surviving that experience, because I knew that I couldn't become the top fighting combat soldier. Mm-hmm. For me, it was becoming effective enough so that I wouldn't find myself dead. So it was survival. That's, I think, the difference. Mm-hmm. I never had enough confidence in myself that I would be a real, I was going to be a great soldier. I just wanted to survive. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do the job. I mean, I was perfectly willing to do the job. I was perfectly willing to go over there. I was perfectly willing to take on the position of a sergeant and that responsibility and go over in that position of responsibility. But the reason I wanted to do it well was so that I would survive the experience.
Hmm. Okay, now one more thing before we get you up to Fort Myer. Yeah. You were in basic and then AIT, and I'm not sure of the timeline, but
one right after the other.
Right, certainly. But what about what I'm thinking about it is the actual, the date here. It really doesn't matter. At the end of January 1968, of course, the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese and Viet Cong unleashed the Tet Offensive of 1968. And it was a lot of different things in a variety of different ways. What did you know about the Tet Offensive?
Well, I was drafted in February.
I was 68.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So I remember learning about it. I remember hearing about it before I was drafted. Certainly I was paying attention to Vietnam and what was happening in Vietnam. And I remember hearing about the Tet Offensive. I remember seeing the images on television before I was drafted. And now that you mention it, it might have been a lot of what had to do with me thinking I need to survive.
Right.
Because I remember feeling like, holy shit, we're getting pounded with this Tet Offensive. And they're really, I think I wondered if we were winning. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that might have been part of it too, because I was aware of it before I went in February.
Okay, now you said that
you got to understand, once you're in basic training, you don't hear anything much from outside
sure.
at all. I mean, you don't. All you get is what the Army wants you to get, and that's pretty much what And that information came mostly from these guys who'd been there and came back.
Mm-hmm. And as a garden variety draftee, you had no reason to know anything.
Right.
When you're in basic.
Exactly.
Now, you mentioned that you said maybe we're not winning this thing. Had you been convinced up to that point that the U.S. was winning?
Yeah, I think so. I think you're going back a number of years, but I think at that point, I felt we were accomplishing whatever mission we had to accomplish there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I remember.
And then Tet kind of throws a bucket of cold water on there.
Exactly.
What were your impressions about the U.S. media coverage of the Tet Offensive? What did the U.S. media tell you as again, a garden variety consumer of news? What did they tell you?
All I remember, and I don't remember the message as much as I remember the visual stuff, because again, I was getting it from TV, and I remember the visuals of all the fighting and the wounded and dead soldiers and just the intensity of that battle. That's my recollection. Mm-hmm. And that's what made an impression on me, because I knew that's where I was going to...
That's where you're going to go.
I was going to go.
There was no question about that's where you're going to go, except for divine intervention, right. Or you were due some good luck, or, right. Or whatever it was.
Right.
You get this call, they say, all right, you're not going with the rest of this outfit.
Right. Oh, one of the things that I did want to bring up about AIT, though, I think that's very interesting and very telling about that period, was that I was in a training company, our squad had, I don't remember the numbers now, if it's 8 or 12, seems like it must be 12 people that you train with. Out of that 12, there were 3 of us that were college graduates, which really surprised me.
Surprised you because of the high number? Or the
high number of college graduates. By then, Johnson had lowered the requirements for people being drafted. I mean, whatever the requirements are, you know, the tests that you have to pass, intellectually, whatever it is, he had lowered the requirements. And so in this squad, there were 3 of us that were college graduates, but there were another 3 who just... I wouldn't trust to give them instruction to go to the end of the hall and turn left. And yet they made it through basic training and they're now in advanced infantry training. And as I went through the 4 weeks that I went through advanced training, it scared the hell out of me that I'd have to depend on them to keep me alive. And I thought, this is not good. This is just really not good, because, you know, maybe there's a group of people there that you're going to be able to depend on, but there's also some people you cannot depend on. If you're in a situation where your life depended on them, you're dead. And it scared the hell out of me. And
now, was it because they were intellectually incapable, or because they were not of very good character, or
both? Both. They were bad. They were. It was probably a mixture of both. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were disadvantaged in life because they were at best average intelligence or below average intelligence, and because of that disadvantage, they were developed different morals, and it's just untrustworthy.
Explain to me why you developed the suppression of these guys. What sort of things were they doing?
They looked after themselves in situations where, you know, they could have helped somebody, and they didn't. When you're involved in group things, you know, you're supposed to help your buddies do things, and they could care less what any happened to anybody else, and they had attitudes. They had challenging attitudes. They were willing to challenge you just because you behaved a certain way, you know, like, you know, or looked at them the wrong way, and they were ready to pick a fight. I mean, I almost got into fights with a couple of these guys a couple of times, and I'm not a fighter. I don't do shit like that. Mm-hmm. And they were just, you know, they were antisocial. That's the best way I could put it. They were, you know, they were not team players. And I thought, out of a group of 12 people, to find 2 or 3 people like that is disproportionate, just like I thought it was disproportionate to find 3 of us who were college graduates. And so it just gave me, it scared me. It really scared me, because I thought, in basic training, I felt some camaraderie with everybody, and I felt everybody was on the same page. I hadn't encountered this group of people But the difference is basic training included a much larger population and a diverse population. And these guys were scattered throughout it, wherever. But now you get into AIT, all these guys were qualified to do was go in to the fodder farm. Mm-hmm. And that's all they were qualified. They couldn't do anything else in the Army except serve as cannon fodder. And so there they were. And there was more of them than I thought should have been there. And I didn't think I was just... It scared me.
Did they treat you differently because of your level of education? Was that part of it as well?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They definitely treated the three of us who were college graduates the same way, and that was with some disdain.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, that I just wanted to point that out because I thought that was I thought the cause and effect was Johnson lowering the standards for because he needed to draft as many people as he could.
And you saw some immediate results of that in AIT.
Yeah. So I was another reason I was really happy to get out. Yes, if I had to go in country with those people, I think I would have shot myself in the foot. That would have been bad news. And the other interesting thing about the situation ultimately is, though, I said I was the first one to be pulled out of that training company. That's what people said. Well, it turns out there were three of us. I had an engineering degree. There's another guy that had an electrical engineering degree, and another guy was an English teacher from New York. And as we were going through training, you get a sense of who can take care of themselves, who can't. I thought I was probably in the best position. If I had to go, I could handle it. You know, I could manage it. I could deal with it. I thought the electrical engineer probably could. A little bit less confidence in him. I thought the least likely person to be able to deal with the situation was the English teacher. I really felt sorry that he was put in this predicament because he was not a fighter. He was not a warrior. I mean, if I had to, I thought I could do it. I didn't think he could do it. It turned out that a couple of weeks after I was pulled out, the electrical engineer was pulled out too. And he was pulled out to work in a lab in Long Island. So he missed it. The only one of the three of us to go over there was the English teacher.
Oh, wow.
And and we communicated for some time. We sent letters for some time until I finally got too guilty. I couldn't stand it, and I stopped. Because I was truly overcome with guilt. His job was spotting for an Arvin unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say he'd go out and patrol and come back and just drink. And he said, that's all I do. He said, I go out, patrol, and come back and drink. He said, the only way I can deal with it. And finally, I honestly carried a great deal of guilt about that for a long, long time because I didn't think he could survive. And I never knew whether he did or not. And it wasn't until I went to the Vietnam Wall and looked for his name. And it wasn't there. That I started to feel a little better, but doesn't mean he survived because I saw what happened. I saw what happened to people who went over there and went through his experience and didn't survive emotionally. I mean, intellectually they were wrecked when they came back. So all I can say is he didn't die. That's all I can say. I don't know if he survived. All I know is he didn't die, and I've never had the courage to follow up with that.
You remember his name? I'm not asking for it, but do you remember his name? Well, obviously you do. You went to see his name on the wall.
I did. Yeah. But, so. Anyway, that was one aspect of that I did want to bring out because I thought it was sort of telling about the quality of soldier that we were putting over there at that time, too.
And the general crapshoot for this guy to not be pulled out when you believe he was clearly less suited for this kind of experience than you were.
Right.
Interesting.
Right.
Well, you're getting pulled out. You're pulled out of AIT somehow miraculously. You were very, very concerned about survival. You haven't offered what your real political thoughts on the war were, but really they don't matter at this point.
At that time, I was still, you know, I was still willing to go over there. I was still willing to do my job. So, you know, I'm still thinking this is what we're supposed to be doing. Mm. Yeah.
And yet, the governor calls almost essentially at midnight and says, okay, let's stay this execution for a while.
Right.
Tell me what that was like for you. When you found out that nobody was joking, that it was the real deal.
I was just absolutely, I couldn't have been happier. The only sad part was leaving those two guys behind.
And you become friends with these guys?
Oh yeah, real, very much so. I mean, we felt, because of that situation, we really did become fairly close in that 4 week period of time. And so I remember walking down the street in Fort Jackson, one of the roads, and just, you know, talking about this, and they were really glad for me, and I was just wishing that they could go with me. And so that was the only hard part about it. Like, I mean, clearing post was just like, let me out of here. I just want to get the fuck out of here. And I still didn't know what was awaiting me. I wasn't quite clear about that. All I knew was that there was an assignment at Fort Jackson. I knew Fort Jackson served the Pentagon, but I wasn't sure what that all meant. And I got leave, you know, between that. I had a couple weeks leave before I had to show up at Fort Myers. So
what did you do on leave? Did you go back to Lebanon?
Oh, I went back to Lebanon. That's okay. Yeah. I had an MG that I bought myself as a graduation present, and I had that stored at my uncle's place, and so I went back there to pick that up and just tool around Lebanon and show up at my relatives in my uniform so they could ooh and ah.
Right. And you could tell them that you weren't going to go to the war.
And I wasn't going to go to the war.
And you knew that for a fact.
Yeah, I knew that for a fact.
Okay, you go to Fort Myers, pick up the store there.
Well, I check in at Fort Myer, and you know, it's a lot looser than, you know, the army I was used to at Fort Jackson.
In what ways?
It's a little more casual. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you show up at the, you sign in, and I mean, you have to act like a soldier, and you do those things. It's just it doesn't, at Fort Jackson, you were treated like a one cog in a big machine, and at Fort Myer it was a little more personal. Mm-hmm. And you know, you felt like there was a, you know, more of a personal connection to you rather than you just being a part of a big mass of people. And I remember, the Pentagon is a huge fucking place, and I remember going, you know, you sign in at Fort Jackson, then you go over to the Pentagon. I don't even remember, I think that was all sort of a daze to me, because I was so overwhelmed with the physical size of the place and the fact that I was there. I remember meeting my boss and learning that I was assigned to the assistant vice chief of staff, the office of the assistant vice chief of staff. I mean, it's all sorts of levels.
Right.
And it was the Management Information Systems Directorate. And that my job was mathematical statistical specialist. I was automatically promoted to get out of basic, I think you're E1, get out of AIT. They promoted me. I don't know when normally people got promoted to E2, but I was promoted to E2 almost right away, and then within 6 months was promoted to E3, so which is the equivalent of sergeant. I was a specialist. Working in an office, in an office environment where half the people were civilian, half of them were military. A couple of the younger ones were ROTC graduates. Most of them were professional military people. And
with advanced educations. Mm-hmm. I mean, the two younger guys both had MBAs, and the older professional military guys all had advanced degrees that they got while they were in the Army. And basically, the function of the office was the Army didn't have its own computer programmers. So any of the systems it developed, it bought from vendors. And so this office was responsible for evaluating and passing judgment on the systems that were coming in from the vendors. Mm-hmm. So it was part of that procurement process. And the story behind why I was there was basically... And the civilians that worked there were all high-level civilians, too, GS 14, 15, 16. And the office, there weren't any enlisted people. The lowest officer was captain. Mm-hmm. And there were a couple of majors and a bunch of lieutenant colonels. And the head of the office was a colonel. They had a secretary, but that's the only non-professional person in the office. And because they were drafting so many college graduates at that time, they thought that what they could do was take advantage of some of the college graduates in professional positions on an enlisted basis. Basically, you know, using their education and paying them diddly squat.
Right.
And so they experimented with this, and they pulled two of us. There's another guy named Sulg, S-U-L-G, who was a fucking genius. They pulled two of us out of advanced training into this office as an experiment. We were the first time they ever tried this. So... they put us into professional positions. Sulg actually, I think, did a lot more professionally than I did. We weren't real buddies. I mean, we were just acquaintances, and he was a real intellectual, nerdy type, and so I think he did more professionally than I did. But I worked for Colonel Hohenstein, who was an artilleryman, and this is where I started to really learn what the Army was about. He was a really nice guy. I liked Colonel Hohenstein a lot. I mean, I really liked him because he pulled me out of advanced infantry.
Right. This is the same colonel you talked to on the phone.
The guy I talked to on the phone. And the reason I believe, I don't know this for a fact, but the reason I think there was an 8-week gap between the time he talked to me and the time that I got the change. I mean, instead of, you know, after 4 weeks, okay, you're going to go to Fort Myer, this required a security clearance. I had to have a secret security clearance. And there's a process that goes along with that, you know, FBI stuff. And so I think it just took that long for the security clearance to pass. Otherwise, I might have been pulled out earlier. Mm-hmm. But that, I mean, doesn't matter to them. They wanted to wait to see if I passed the security clearance, I guess. And it makes sense. So this was an experiment. The fact of the matter is, though, that the people running the office are all professional military people. True. I mean, Hohenstein had been to Vietnam once as a lieutenant colonel, and he was unabashed about saying, I'm doing this because I have to, but I really need to get back to Vietnam. I want to go back to Vietnam and fire some more howitzers. You know, that's not the words he used, but he needed his second tour in Vietnam to get his ticket punched so that professionally he could advance.
It wasn't a matter that he enjoyed the combat or the action.
He wanted to get
his ticket puncher.
Ticket punched. And I heard that more often. I heard that so much that I finally came to believe that the war was serving a purpose other
than what we were told it was serving. It was serving professional military advancement. Mm-hmm. And that's what it was serving. Without a war, they couldn't advance. And they needed this war in order to advance. And I became pretty much convinced of that. Now, that wasn't true of everyone, because there were some professional management information system people there. They had to have them because of the responsibility.
Right.
And there were two, there was a lieutenant colonel and a major who were just purely professional MIS people, and that was their job. And they were never going to, they weren't artillerymen, they were, I don't even know what branch they were in, but the guy who was running it, in running my office, was a professional artilleryman, and that's, he was only doing this as because he had to. Mm-hmm. He wanted to get back and fight the war. And, but because they were professional military people, they also had a disdain for enlisted people. Mm-hmm. You know, enlisted people in their mind were people who just did the menial things, and they had a real difficult time seeing me in a professional capacity.
Even worse, you were a draftee.
And even worse, I was a draftee. And I didn't have an advanced degree. I just had my basic degree, and most of these people had an advanced degree. And so there was some disdain there, I think, for what I was doing. And I spent as much time working in a professional capacity as I did getting coffee or doing the slides for slide presentations, which was part of the best thing I did there. I did do some professional analysis. I did on some less important systems. Mm-hmm. You know,
such as what?
Well, the system, the one that I remember was an MOS, a system that predicted MOS needs. Mm-hmm. You know, it looked at what the existing requirements are, and projected what you're going to need going out in the future. And so you fed data into it, and it gave you these projections that you could then use to determine what you needed, what kind of people you needed to enlist, and how you needed to train them. And so it was, a basic forecasting system. Mm-hmm. And I remember analyzing that system and determining that it did exactly what they wanted it to do. It was a sophisticated system, but it didn't have to be. And the vendor, I don't remember, it was Booz Allen, did what they were paid lots of money to do, and made tons of money on doing it. And that's the other thing I realized, because I got to meet a number of vendors through the experience, all of whom were former military. Mm-hmm. And that's when I learned about the military-industrial complex, and that's when, what's his name, who's the whistleblower? My memory's gone. About that, in that time, there was somebody who really raised the stink about the policies. Oh, what's his name?
I don't know.
I can't think. Anyway, I learned about the military-industrial complex and how they just, the military, you know, you look forward to retiring from the military so you could go get a job working for a military vendor so you get your retirement and get the money from the vendor that came from the military and double dip. I mean,
right.
it was just too common not to say it was a practice. I mean, it was alive. The military-industrial complex was alive and well, and I still think it's alive and well. And that's one of the things I learned. So I'm not complaining at all. I think I was the luckiest stiff in the world. I did have a chance one day when I was the only person in the office to look in Colonel Hohenstein's desk drawer and look at his files for the people who were considered for this job. And there were another three or four people that were in his file.
and I looked at their backgrounds. Every one of them had a better background than me.
Huh.
Every one of them, I mean, there was at least one who had an advanced degree. There were a couple others that had better experience than I had. I was convinced that he made a mistake, that he actually thought I was one of the others.
Is that right?
I don't know. I mean, I never had the courage to ask him. I mean, I was frankly afraid that he'd realize he made a mistake and I'd be gone. So I never asked him why he chose me. All I know is that when I looked at those files, if I were making the decision, I would have picked a different person.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I always think I used up all my luck. Because it was pure-ass luck that I was chosen to do that job. And, you know, the simple fact of the matter is, after Solg and I finished our tours, they didn't do it again.
Hmm.
They didn't use draftees to do that job again. It was a one-time only deal. So we were very, very lucky. Now, the reason I said that showing slides was a good thing, because it gave me access to some people, proximity to some people I never, ever, ever, ever would have had proximity to in my life.
Such as who?
The Secretary of the Army. The Westmoreland.
You met Westmoreland, or were in a room with Westmoreland?
In a room with Westmoreland. In a room with Secretary of the Army, in a room with Westmoreland, in a room with the Senate Armed Forces Committee, because we were making presentations about management information systems that these people had to pass judgment on. I was the one who was doing the slide work while the officers were making the presentation. So I got to be in the room or behind the screen.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of Reeser, who was the Secretary of the Army at the time, and Westmoreland, I was in the room because they did it that way. With the Senate committee, I was behind a screen. And then there were other presentations too, like it's a command structure, so incredible. But I was what happened with the access that I had to information about what was happening, I came to believe that we were in the war for the wrong reasons. And I no longer felt that we were there defending democracy against communism. I felt that we were there for selfish reasons.
Well, you were looking at it from the perspective of, not from the perspective of a bureaucrat, but you were around the bureaucrats.
Right.
And you saw the view, right, the war from their view, which wasn't much of a war in what we generally think of. Right. Not like the combat soldier who can see, right, the tangible results,
right,
good and bad, positive and negative. You see the children, you see the action, the blood, and all these kind of things, right, which could, I think, would tend to drive home some very positive parts about the American involvement in the war and individual soldiers' involvement in the,
right,
war. But you're seeing it from a vastly different, more corporate side of it.
Right.
And what you're saying you're not like
it. Not like it at all.
Personal advancement, military contracts.
Right.
All the things getting lost in the shuffle.
Right.
The accidental job that you get for no real reason, just an, right, experiment.
Right. Right. I lived in for the first 6 months I was there, until I was promoted to E3, I lived on a barracks on base. And I had, you know, I listened to, there were some people who were assigned who came back from Vietnam, and I didn't hear any positive experiences from the people who were coming back from Vietnam. And so I didn't feel like the war on the ground was really being effective, because none of the information I was getting directly from them was the case. And all of the information I was getting directly showed me that the war was being fought for the wrong reasons, and not the reasons that we were being told it was being fought for.
I started to become very disillusioned, and I became aware of the protests that were going on for the first time, and I actively became interested in the protests that were going on for the first time because I felt like it was the wrong thing, and we were not doing the right thing, and I became convinced of that pretty much.
Now there's a subtle difference, I think, between being opposed to the war and for the reasons that you were opposed to the war. Were you opposed to it in the more traditional vein of we're in the wrong place in the wrong time, and American soldiers are killing Vietnamese, that it's not about the stopping the spread of communism, that sort of thing, or were you more, like you say, disillusioned with what you could call corruption, and it, probably not technically corruption, but it was certainly a corrupt system, I think.
I think that was it. I felt people were fighting the war for self-interest rather than the good of mankind, which is what I thought the war was being fought for initially, and that's why I was willing to fight it, is I thought this was we're doing it for the betterment of this country and the world, I no longer felt that way. I no longer felt anybody really cared about Vietnam, that they only cared about themselves and what they were getting out of the experience, and what was happening on the ground in Vietnam was not as important as generally the ability to, you know, the fact that we're fighting a war, we're having a war experience. That seemed almost
incidental to what was going on in Washington D.C.
Yeah,
fighting itself.
Right. Right, and so it's so yeah, you're right, and I had very little understanding of the immediacy of the impact of what the soldiers were going through. I only heard the negative things about what they went through, and I don't really felt I related to the positive or negative things that might have been going on in Vietnam as much as I just thought it was we were not doing it for the right reasons at all. Mm. Not at all.
Now, you said you became actively interested in protests.
Right.
This was essentially for you a 9-to-5 job, wasn't that right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you would put on your uniform, you go to work, you crunch numbers,
yeah.
You get off work, then your time is your own there in Washington, D.C.
Right.
How did you become actively interested? What was the contact that you made? How did you approach this?
Well, it wasn't on a day-to-day basis because it still had restrictions. I mean, there on a day-to-day basis, I mean, frankly, my life wasn't any different from any other soldier. You still, especially in the barracks, you just look for outlets. You'd get out and you go out with your buddies.
Mm.
And that's pretty much what I did. On weekends, I was fortunate. Living in Washington, weekends, I could go home. So Friday night, I'd drive to Pennsylvania, and I'd stay in Pennsylvania for the weekend, and then I'd drive back Sunday night. And so I'd have, I just have to spend the weekdays in Fort Myers. And so that was, I was living sort of a normal life on weekends with my family. And then during the, this is the other thing I should mention to you too. I had a cousin that lived in Falls Church, Virginia, mm-hmm. and wonderful, wonderful family. They were older. They were in their 50s at the time, but they invited me into their home like I was one of their children, and I spent a lot of my the times I didn't go to Pennsylvania, I'd go out to their place for the weekend. And so I had a family connection there as well. And I'd go there some evenings as well. And evenings I didn't go with them, I hung out with my buddies who were on base. And we'd go out drinking like soldiers everywhere do. And,
right.
And I did my fair share of going out drinking with them and hanging out with them. I didn't make the only connection
I didn't make any direct connection with the protest. The only time I made a direct connection was on the 69 march in Washington. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. The day before the march, I was in a briefing, again behind the scenes briefing, and it was interesting. There was a presentation before me, and we got there early just because my boss always wanted to get there early. And there was a presentation before me that hadn't gone on yet, and the senior NCO who was in charge of the place said, "Well, you've got a top secret clearance, right?" I said, "Oh yeah," which I didn't. I said, "Oh yeah, no problem." And he said, "Okay, fine." And so we were just setting up, and so I was backstage for this first presentation, which was a top secret presentation. And what this was about was all of the preparations they were making for this march on Washington. They had troops set up everywhere around and in Washington. They had armor staged around Washington, ready to come in Washington, because they thought this was going to be a really violent protest. So the military was completely set up for this protest. I mean, I can't imagine how much money was set up for this. I mean, the only thing that the American public saw, because all of this was shrouded, the only thing the American public saw was the buses around the White House. You know, Nixon put the buses all around the White House, so you couldn't get through there. And then it turned out that the protest was relatively peaceful. I mean, the SDS did some stuff. They did some stuff Friday night, and they did some stuff Saturday, but it was relatively... I mean, the SDS was such a fringe group, and the masses were completely peaceful. So anyway, the day before, the Friday before, I was in this brief, top-secret briefing, hearing about all the Army's plans to hold back these protesters because they were going to be violent. And then that night, and then we were all restricted to base, which was ridiculous because once you got to be E3, you could live off base. And I was living off base in a rented room at the time. But you were restricted to base, which means that no military is supposed to be out in the streets. Well, too bad. So that night they had a candlelight march from Arlington around the White House. Mm-hmm. And you each carried the name of a soldier that had been killed, along with a candle, which you only, it was a candle about like that, which you only lit when you're walking around the White House. And I still have that candle.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, I still have that candle.
What led you to want to take part in this?
Everything I'd learned to that point, you know, in the year that I'd spent at that point in Washington and working in the Pentagon. I didn't think it was the right thing to do. I thought that everyone who'd been killed had been murdered. You know, they were just sent over to die for not the right reason. And it was very emotional. I mean, I really felt very emotional being involved with those protesters. And then the next day was the big march down the... what's it called?
The mall.
Mall. And I went to that as well. I still have the buttons, the peace buttons I have that I bought at the march. I still have those.
You could have gotten in trouble for this, couldn't you?
I could have been court-martialed. If they would have realized, anybody would have realized that I was a soldier, I would have been court-martialed for being AWOL. But again, that was one of the most incredible experiences of my life, being in that group of people with that purpose. And it was totally peaceful. I mean, these people, all they wanted was to end the war. And they, you know, like I said, there was a fringe, and I saw the fringe, you know, at the end of the march. There were these few SDS people raising hell, but
but for the most part, it was just hundreds of thousands of people just wanting to end the war. And it was a very moving experience, and it made me feel like this was the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. That the other thing was not the right thing to do, this was the right thing to do. These people had the right idea, and so that was the extent to how I got involved with it. I participated in the march. I wasn't doing any other subversive things or contact things. I just participated in the march.
You've explained the aura and the feeling of participating in this march and the purpose, but what in a very real or tangible sense, what were the mechanics of this? What were you going to do? Did you have to approach someone and say, look, I want a candle, I want this soldier's name, I want to participate? Was there a group of leadership?
There was a leadership on Friday night, certainly. You had to go to the coordinating point and, get those things, get the name, and they pretty much, you were told how to do the candlelight march. In terms of the mall march, I mean, there was organization to the extent that, generally you were told this is where we're going and this is the direction we're going, and then that's about it. There wasn't any, there were just too many people to be completely organized. There were hundreds of thousands of people. I forget the number that ultimately showed up in that march, but it was horrendous. I've never seen so many people in my life. It was quite amazing.
Were there any difficulties in any of this?
No.
Trying to get from place to place? No. Or
not at all. Not at all.
Pretty smoothly then.
Yeah, everything went smoothly. Like I said, with the exception at the end of the march on Saturday. Well, I learned later that the SDS had caused some trouble in Georgetown Friday night, but I wasn't even closer around that. And then I saw at the end of the march on Saturday at the north part of the mall there were some problems too, and the police were interacting with some of the protesters who were, I think, more probably SDS.
You were by yourself? You knew no one else in there?
Nope.
Completely by yourself. You just thought, this is a good cause, and I'm going to essentially defy orders, and I'm going to participate in this thing.
Right.
Completely alone.
Yep. Nobody was with me.
Did you make any friends, any contacts, anyone you still stay in contact with?
No, I was just one of the masses.
That's really cool. When the march is over, your feelings aren't going to change, your job doesn't change, the war's
actually, my feelings changed a little bit.
Is that right? How so?
I thought I was more convinced than ever that, the people who are protesting. I mean, I was aware of the protests, I was aware of what people were doing. I thought that was probably the right thing to do. Having participated in the march, I was totally convinced. There was no question in my mind that these people were on the right track.
Did you do anything to follow up on this feeling? Did you become more active in the anti-war movement?
No, because then I shortly thereafter, I don't remember what date that was, but I went back and did my job, and then went back to work. And by that time, I was... Again, this was part of my education. I think in that office, I said there were a couple of young officers who had MBAs. And these guys, being exposed to these guys and talking to these guys, interacting with them, and they treated me very well. It was only the senior officers that used me like a peon. Mm-hmm. These guys interacted with me and talked to me, and I learned a lot from them. I mean, there was one lieutenant colonel as well who was a sports car enthusiast and knew I had an MG, and I was over to his place several times for dinner. But I interacted with these two young officers who were just, three or four years my senior. And in talking to them, I was pretty well convinced that what I wanted to do was get an MBA. That's the direction I wanted to go into my life. And so I spent some time while I was in the Army looking at where I'd want to go. One of them happened to go to UVA and suggested UVA, and so I I went through the process of applying to UVA and getting ready to go in that direction. I went back, as soon as I got out of the Army, I went back to my job at Bell Telephone because I still had that job, but I was pretty well convinced I was going to go to graduate school. I'm sorry, but I have to go to the bathroom again.
That's fine. That's just, great.
Yeah.
Okay, pick it up. You want to say something?
Yeah. I mean, by the time that I was discharged, the last day, it was sort of funny. I don't remember a lot of the time between the march and the time I was discharged. There was a couple month period there. I think I just played out my time, did what I had to do to get out. I just was ready to get out. I was just really ready to get out. I couldn't stand the thought of being associated with the military anymore. And the last day, they gave me a commendation for the work that I did on that one system, an Army Commendation Medal, which it was nice that I got it and I put it in my resume, but I remember everybody was so pleased that they'd done this for me, and I remember going, and I don't know anything about military protocol. I didn't know I was supposed to stand at attention and all this shit. I sort of just slouched there, and they gave me my medal, and I shook their hands and stuff. And oh, the other thing I forgot, another reason why my tour of duty there was so easy is I mentioned the secretary. Mm-hmm. I forgot about that. The secretary in this office, Betty Hitchcock, was a really, really nice woman in her 50s. She was the sister of, goddamn. Do you remember the TV show that was about, it was a comedy about these cavalry?
F-Troop.
Who is the star in Beth Troop?
Oh, Ken Berry and Forrest Tucker.
Forrest Tucker. She was Forrest Tucker's sister. And she befriended me and one of the other guys that I developed a relationship with, who worked in the Pentagon as well. He and I forget which directorate he worked in, but I think we were in the barracks together, and we maintained some sort of friendship. But he was from Pennsylvania, that's why I think we initially sort of hit it off. And so I spent a lot of time at her place too. I'd go over there for evenings, and she and her mother, who lived around there as well, who was a real character. Forrest Tucker's mother was a real character. And she had another brother too, as a painter, who painted some really amazing, outrageous stuff. I hung out there a lot too. Forgot about that. I became real good friends with her. So I mean, my enlisted experience was pretty easy. It was a lot of friendships and a lot of family, so the time outside of work was fairly easy. And I even maintained that relationship a little bit after she actually came to visit Linda and I when we were living in Philadelphia.
Oh wow!
Yeah, yeah. So it was a nice relationship. And anyway, that last day, I couldn't wait. I just couldn't wait. And I got my medal and walking out of the Pentagon with my friend. He decided to take a couple of weeks leave. And we were going to drive down to Florida for a week just to blow off some steam. He'd been given a new convertible, Pontiac convertible, by his uncle, who was an insurance agent. And so we were going to take his Pontiac convertible and drive to Florida. And he had some friends, a couple of girls, who had an apartment that we were going to stay at. And so he and I left together because we were going to start our road trip. And I remember you leave the Pentagon and you walk underground underneath the highways, and then you come up to Fort Myer, and all I had to do to clear base at that time was to get in my car and drive away. I had my duffel bag packed and stuff, everything ready to go. So I get out and I just
I just take off my, which you're not, you know, you stay in uniform the whole time you're there. You don't mess with that. I took off my hat, unloosened my tie, unbuttoned my jacket, and just am walking away from the Pentagon, and this colonel comes up to me. I don't even salute him. I'm just walking past. He says, "Soldier!" He said, "What are you doing? You can't put on that. Put on, the, oh, I forget what they call it, cover up or something, and straighten up that tie. What are you buttoning your jacket?" And you salute an officer. I said, "So long." And I kept going. He says, "You're not out of the Army yet. You're still in the Army." And I said, "Yeah, yeah." I kept going. And he was just pissed as hell. And he says, what could he do? He couldn't do anything. All he could do was vent his frustration by yelling at me. But that was my last little say fuck you thing, and I just walked away. And
Nothing became of it.
Got in my car and drove away.
Wow.
But I had it. I just couldn't deal with it anymore. I mean, it would have been so easy for me just to go off and get in my car and then unbutton, but I just felt like, fuck it, I can't do it. I can't do it. So, and I was done with it.
You were certainly disillusioned with the Army by this time.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
All right, now you get out in, when it would have been 1970?
Yep.
You finished your...
Yep, February of 70.
February of 1970.
Yep.
Now, the U.S. is going to be involved in this war, well, until it ends in 75, but the American fighting portion of it, it's winding down somewhat with Nixon and Vietnamization and all of that. But the war is going to last for essentially 2 years, the American phase over 2 years after you leave. How closely were you still paying attention to the war? Or were you?
Oh, I was paying attention to it. I mean, I felt like I had some knowledge that other people didn't have, so every chance I had to talk about it, I talked about my experience and how it was a wrong war. I mean, I never, from that time on, I never, in any conversation whatsoever, had anything positive to say about us being in the war and the fact that we need to be out.
Did you do this openly in public at anti-war?
No, I didn't participate in the protests. I didn't go that far. I was too involved in my own stuff by that time, because I had decided to go back to school, and within a couple of months I met Linda, and women always took a high priority in my interest. Linda certainly did, and I decided to go back to school, and I did go back to school, but then we found out we were pregnant, and we were actually depending on her to support me while I was in graduate school, because I didn't have enough money on my own to go to graduate school. The money I get from the service wasn't enough to pay for everything, so Linda was going to support me while I went to graduate school, and when we found out she was pregnant, realized that that wasn't going to work, and so after one semester I dropped out and thought I could go back to my old job, but they said, "Nah, you know, after this much time, we're paying you too much for what you're worth." And
back at Bell,
yeah. And this was 1970, and there was a recession in 1970, and there were unemployed engineers all over the place. And it turned out I wasn't working for 3 months, which was good, because that gave Linda and I 3 months together, 24/7, and we became really good friends over that. You know, we got to know each other and had a relationship, but I think as that 3 month period of time, we really became friends. We really became good friends in that 3 month period of time. In that time, I really needed a job, because we were basically living on unemployment checks. I finally did get a job. But through all of that experience, starting school, developing that new relationship, finding a job, being unemployed, finding a job, I had too many... I there were no outside activities I got involved in, none whatsoever. And it was all sort of living my life. And it's just in any situation, you know, where we were involved socially in anything, and the subject of the war came up, I voiced my opinion on my views on the subject. That's about it. I wasn't actively protesting in any way, shape, or form.
The war is going to continue. What did you think about the fall of Saigon, which effectively ends the war in April 1975?
It seemed to me that it was pretty pathetic. It was pretty... I saw the events transpiring and thought it was just... somehow it was a really a rather ignominious end to a bad situation. I felt really sorry that we had put the South Vietnamese in the position that they were in, because I felt they weren't going to do well coming out of this with the North Vietnamese and having to deal with all of that political struggle. And I thought it was really sad. I wasn't sad for what... I mean, I thought it was... what's the word? Embarrassing for the United States. I thought it was really embarrassing to see those pictures and to see what was happening in terms of the way we left the country. And I thought it was... That was embarrassing, but I thought we deserved it. I remember feeling really sorry for the South Vietnamese, that I think I thought we screwed them, and I really thought we didn't do justice to them at all.
You were not particularly proud of your service, your affiliation with the Army.
No.
When you left.
No.
Now, looking back on it all these years later, has that changed at all?
No. I mean, I am proud that I did my duty, and I'm proud. And I am proud to say that I would have done that duty no matter what it was. I mean, I can't tell how I would have handled it. I don't know how I would have handled it if I was actually faced with having to, with a combat situation. I don't know if anybody can until they are, but I would have done that. And I put in the same situation again, I would have done it. It's just the things that I learned while I was involved that changed my opinion about that experience, and I don't... I'm proud to have done the duty that I did, but I'm not proud of the circumstance that caused me to do that duty. I don't think that the Vietnam conflict was the right thing to do, and I've changed my mind about that.
What sort of lessons do you think there are from the American involvement?
Be sure you understand the culture that you're getting yourself involved in. I mean, I think it was presented to me when Linda had the opportunity to go to Hanoi, and I went to Hanoi for 3 weeks, and I saw their war museum. I felt like if there's any senior American official would have spent an hour in that goddamn museum, they would have said, this is going to be the wrong thing to do. We cannot prevail if we come over here. Their war museum has rooms filled with mothers' pictures. And these are women who've all had sacrificed sons or husbands in conflicts starting with the Chinese, the French. I mean, these people have fought invaders. This small little country has fought off invaders for centuries and centuries. And you look at these pictures of these women who they're honoring. They're honoring the mothers and wives of the soldiers who have given themselves for their country, and they're saying, these are our heroes. A country like that has got more national pride and more willingness to sacrifice themselves than we'll ever know. And how you can believe that you even want to, that you even think that you have the right to go in and tell them how they should live their lives, I don't understand. I mean, they are determining how they're going to live their lives. And just because a European country comes in and says, we want your natural resources, doesn't mean that you can tell them how to run their lives. They have to, there's that self-determination that they're not going to give up. The Vietnamese certainly are never going to give up. I mean, I was incredibly impressed with that. And as well, you know, in meeting the father of the family where Linda stayed, who fought in the war, traveled up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, dealt with incredible hardships, and was completely magnanimous. You know, we don't hold anything against Americans. They're just the latest invaders, and, you know, it's okay. You know, we can deal with it. It's okay. You know, we just want you to know that we're all right with it, and we understand. And if there's a lesson to learn, you have to understand the country that you're going into and why you're going into, the reason you're going into it. I'm still not convinced. Well, I'm convinced that we're playing out something similar in the Middle East, because we're there for the wrong reasons too. We're there for some other purpose than to help that country. I mean, ultimately, maybe that country will be helped, but I don't know that for sure. I know that the Vietnamese are self-determined. I know that they have a vision of what they want. And certainly there are differences between North and South, because there are differences between the North and South in this country. People have different attitudes based on some geography, and yet they're still a unified nation. I mean, even given the civil conflict, just as we are. That doesn't, just because there are those civil conflicts doesn't mean that we have a right to go in there and tell them how to resolve it. And had we thought about that reasonably, I don't know if we should have gotten involved. I mean, I think we were involved for the wrong reasons. We didn't understand the culture. We didn't understand what the people were really like. And if there's a lesson learned, you've got to know that before you go into a country. I don't know if we've done that in Iraq at all. I don't think we, you know, we think we can resolve the difference between the denominations in Iraq. I don't know.
That's a bright, cheerful note. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we end the interview?
Well, I think it's. I don't really think we do learn from history. I wish we did, but I don't think we do, because there. I think power corrupts people, and I think, again, this is my prejudice, and I admit to it that it's a prejudice, but I think once people get in political power or in organization power, they disassociate themselves from reality, and they see what they want to see, and they don't see what reality is, and they're more willing to listen to people who are going to reinforce their perspective than they are to objectively look at what the situation is, you know, and I think that's really unfortunate, because there's so much to learn from history and so much to learn from this experience that I'm not confident that we have learned it.
All right, well, thank you very much.
Sure.